Wednesday, IPO headquarters. "Easy there, slugger," he said gently, putting a hand to her forehead. Laura's jade eyes flickered open.
"Benjamin?"
"I'm right here. Take it slow. You just took a hell of a ride." She tried to sit up, then let herself flop back into bed.
"This is not the lab," she observed.
Griffin shook his head. "No, it's Recovery One." Gesturing to the bedclothes and pillows, as well as the generally homier and less clinical decor of the room, he added with a smile, "More comfortable."
"The procedure?"
"A complete success, as far as we can tell right now," said Skuld from the doorway. "You blacked out at around 85%, which is not that surprising, given that your body temperature hit 115 degrees, and your heart rate topped 300 BPM right about then. By rights, you should be dead about 6 different ways. Still, I want to observe things for a little while. You need rest, anyway. We pushed even your system right to the edge of the envelope tonight."
Laura shook her head and tried to rise. "I have to prepare."
"Relax, Laura," said Griffin, pushing her gently back down by one shoulder. "I've got my people on full alert. We'll know when she enters the city, and then we can get excited. For now, get some sleep." She looked like she might protest further for a moment, but then subsided, perhaps realizing how tired she was.
"All right," she said, "but tell me the moment she arrives."
He nodded. "I will. I told you. I understand what this all means to you. I wouldn't have done what we just did otherwise, even if you insisted on it. You have my word. My people and I won't interfere. Just let us be your eyes for the moment." He bent and kissed her forehead. "Rest."
"I will."
As he straightened to go, she reached up, took his hand for a moment, then let it go.
"Thank you."
Griffin nodded and left the recovery room. As soon as he was in the hall with the door closed behind him, he sagged visibly, trudged to a couch along the opposite wall, and threw himself into it, dragging his hands down his face.
"I never want to see that happen to another person as long as I live," he said. "Destroy that goddamn machine."
"Already done," Skuld said. She sat down next to him, a hand on his arm. "It was scrap before she got down here."
"Good."
He sat fully back, face upturned to the ceiling, and let out a huge sigh.
"Monsters. Monsters."
"That they were, old friend," a voice agreed, and Griffin lifted and turned his head to see Victor Creed approaching down the hall, followed closely by Jeff Depew.
"Victor," he said, surprised. Dragging himself out of the couch, he went to have his forearm clasped, then asked, "How did you get here so fast?"
"Your organization saw fit to spare no expense on my behalf, for which I am profoundly grateful."
Creed turned to Skuld, his leonine face breaking into a winning, slightly fangy smile.
"You can be none other than the famous Dr. Skuld Ravenhair. I must say your universal reputation for beauty and brilliance is now revealed to have been naught but the palest imitation of the truth."
He bowed deeply, kissed her hand, and said,
"Sir Victor Creed, Baronet Creedmance of Clan Fairpool Wingwingle, your servant, madam."
Skuld went slightly pink, but she learned court manners in Asgard, so she didn't falter as she replied,
"The pleasure is mine, Sir Victor. Welcome to the Enrichment Center."
"Thank you very kindly."
Turning back to Griffin, Creed asked, "I trust the procedure went well?" "As well as can be expected. She's pretty wrung out. We've got her resting right now. You can go say hello if you like, but I want her to stay in bed for at least the next 6 hours. Creed nodded.
"I shan't disturb her then. Enough for now that I know she's recovering."
His golden eyes twinkling with the not altogether pleasant animation, he went on,
"Now, pray what are we doing about the miserable harridan who has driven her to this reckless extremity?"
"There'll be a briefing in my situation room upstairs in 10 minutes," Griffin told him. "I'll introduce you to the team, and we'll get all the information we have out on the table."
"Fair enough. I shall await your convenience."
He bowed once more, kissed Skuld's hand again, and swept off toward the elevators in a manner that reminded them both a bit of Lord Farvignugan.
"Well," said Skuld when he'd gone, "he's an original."
"One of your dad's own prototypes," Griffin agreed.
"Jeff, how did you know to call Victor?"
"Remember when I went to New Snowdonia last August for that poetry competition?"
"Yeah, that seemed a bit odd for you."
Jeff shrugged.
"Well, when you've got a personal invite from one of the nobility, it's bad form to turn it down. Anyway, he has a picture of her on his desk, and when I asked who she was, he got a little misty and changed the subject. I assumed she was his daughter or something. When I saw her here, I called him and then the transport pool."
Griffin smiled.
"Well, good call anyway. Is Logan here yet?"
"He and the Griffins just hit the lobby. I came down to tell you that everybody's here who's coming."
"Right. Well, let's get this show on the road, then."
2335, Omega. Griffin sat on the sofa in another, somewhat more substantial, rented res block on a higher, tonier level of Omega. 273 million credits, a sum which, while substantial in its own right, had probably represented little more than the facility's petty cash, could go pretty far even in a place like this. In the corner of the room, the TV was running the evening newscast with the sound off. Under footage of a crew of maintenance droids securing a permanent hull patch over what had been the facility's main entrance, a ticker crawl was saying, "Reactor malfunction destroys abandoned 4th District underward. No casualties reported." Which was true as far as it went. Certainly nobody in the facility had reported any casualties to what passed for the authorities around here. By the time the modified reactor had flashed all the complex's EPS lines to plasma and gutted its interior spaces in a microsecond of incandescent glory, there was nobody alive in there anyway.
I wasn't really watching the TV. My attention was on the portable computer I'd set up on the coffee table. For the last 6 hours or so, I'd been completely engrossed in the contents of the data solid I found on the late Dr. Sarah Kinney. It contained the complete specifications of Weapon X Mark 23, right down to the full sequence of her genome, as well as dossiers on a number of the key players in the project. Dr. Rice's, in particular, did nothing to cause me second thoughts about having dispatched the man. Schematics for modifications that had not yet been performed, and mission development templates for use by operational planners. None of that particularly surprised me. What surprised me was the cover letter, so to speak, that enclosed the whole package. This consisted of a video message recorded by Dr. Kinney herself, one in which, occasionally tearfully, she explained her role in the project. On her part, if her account was to be believed, and I suspected it could, for the most part, it was a classic story of good intentions gone wrong. I figured she was leaving out at least part of the story. Surely she hadn't originally agreed to join such an effort thinking they were going to be doing good things for the galaxy at large, after all. But the woman who recorded the message was clearly at her wit's end with remorse and horror at what she had helped to happen. She'd spent the last few hours of her life trying to make things right. She'd failed. And it could be argued that the effort was too little and far too late. But at least she'd made the attempt. I could respect that. And if nothing else, at least she'd included in her message the name her daughter Laura had never known she had. I'd watched the message 3 times and had it pretty well memorized before I stirred myself to close the viewer, eject the data solid from the computer, and pack both items away in my kit bag. We would have to move out as soon as Laura woke up. Kind of a weird feeling, knowing someone's name before she learns it herself. The chances were good that there were no loose ends from this operation. Genom's black labs were usually so well compartmented that there'd be no one else in the terminus who even knew it was there. It'd take days, maybe even weeks, for the destruction of this lab to come to the attention of the company hierarchy. There were other people, though, who would probably hear about it sooner, but I didn't want to be around if any of them came to investigate.
As he had the thought, he heard the familiar sound of the door being overridden. Grumbling internally about the ever-increasing efficiency of the universe's machinery for annoying him, he drew one of his blasters and positioned himself in a crouch behind the end of the sofa, out of the direct line of the doorway. A moment later, the door opened and a single figure entered. "You might as well come out," said Arya Taloque calmly. "I know you're here, and if I wanted a throwdown, we'd already be having it." Griffin straightened up, putting away the weapon. He knew Arya spoke the truth. She very generally did, which was a curious trait for an avowed underworld kingpin. But then, Arya was a collection of many curious traits, even for an Asari crime boss. "Arya," he said with a cordial nod. "Griff," she replied, and then without further preamble, "You want to tell me what you were up to in the Fourth Ward last night?" Griffin shrugged. "Well, you know me and Genom." "So it was a Genom Black facility. I had my suspicions, but they never did anything to make me curious enough to involve myself. Any loose ends?" "Not as far as I know." She gave him a skeptical look. "The front desk said you checked in with a young girl. Looked to be in pretty bad shape." Arya advanced a few paces into the room with a languid stride, settled herself on an arm of the couch, and said, "Now I happen to know that getting your freak on with underage trinkets is not one of your usual kicks, and damaging the merchandise even less so. So I'm betting credits to Klein Hurungar, she's not your entertainment. She's involved in whatever's going on." "Well," Griffin replied with an ease that the look in his eyes belied, "far be it from me to bet against you in your own establishment, but..." He shook his head. "She's nothing you'd be interested in." Arya arched a brow ridge. "Really?" "Really." "I don't believe you." Griffin shrugged again. "That's not my problem." Arya narrowed her eyes. "I can make it your problem." "Let it go, Arya," Griffin said. "She's a 15-year-old girl who's been tortured all her life. She's never even been allowed to learn her own name. You aren't heartless enough to exploit that, and even if you were, I wouldn't let you." He locked eyes with her and said coldly, "Go ahead and try me. Her makers did." The air rippled faintly around Arya as she stood up and met his arctic stare. Then she smirked, relaxing, and the effect faded away. "You are such a soft touch," she said. "It'll get you killed one day." "Maybe," Griffin agreed. "But on the other hand, someday it might save me." Arya laughed lightly. "Don't ever change, Rescue Ranger," she said. Then, in a slightly harder tone, she added, "And be off my station by 1630. The Crimson Lance knows you took something valuable from that lab, and they're going to come looking for it. I don't want another bloodbath this week." Griffin inclined his head, acknowledging the elegance with which Arya could phrase a warning as a threat to preserve her badass image of herself, and assured her that they would be long gone by then. With one final bit of posturing for form's sake, "You'd better," she took her leave. He finished packing up what few things he had out here, then went into the bedroom. X-23 was sitting up in bed. All but the worst of the outward signs of her injuries had gone, and those which remained had faded. She still looked like she'd been in a car crash, but now an uninformed observer would have guessed that it had happened a month or so ago, or that she'd been in a fairly minor fistfight the day before. "Good morning, Laura," he said, smiling. "You look a lot better than you did last night." She gave him a puzzled look. "What did you call me?" "Laura. It's your name," he explained. "I have a name?" "You do. You always have," Griffin told her gently. "Dr. Kinney just wasn't allowed to tell you what it was." X-23, Laura, looked like she wasn't sure exactly how to take that on board. After a moment, she seemed to give up trying for the moment in favor of observing, "Arya was here." Griffin nodded. "She was." "You nearly fought her." "Nah," he said with a dismissive wave. "Her heart wasn't in it. She just had to make the gesture." He went into the bathroom and started gathering things up. "Can you walk? We need to get gone." She got carefully out of bed, testing the soundness of her limbs, then reported, "I can walk." "Good." By the time Griffin emerged from the bathroom and stuffed his wash bag into its pocket on the end of his duffel, she had dressed in the unobtrusive civvies he'd acquired for her and was slowly, methodically lacing up her boots. Her fingers were still stiff and obviously a little painful, but she got the job done, then straightened with nary a wince and reported herself ready to go. Checkout, the first of the three potential crisis points in their exfil plan, went without a hitch. So did the ride on the Omega internal transit system to the docking ring. As they approached the ring, though, gaining access to it looked like it might become the problem of the day. A squad of Crimson Lance troopers had set up an impromptu security checkpoint at the docking ring companionway and were checking everyone's documents. "Uh-oh," Griffin muttered. "This could get awkward." "I will handle it," said Laura. Before he could stop her, she'd broken away from him and headed straight for the checkpoint. For a second, Griffin thought she was going to attack them, which was straightforward enough, he supposed, but not very advisable. Until he realized that, two strides away from him and just before the Crimson Lancers noticed her, her body language had abruptly transformed into the stiff-legged, fist-clenched carriage of a very angry teenager. "Are you guys the law in this hellhole?" she demanded of the Lancers.
"What?"
the one with Sergeant Stripes replied.
"I said, are you guys the law in this hellhole?" Laura snapped, her voice full of teenage disdain. "God! Take your head out of that bucket and listen if you can't do it from in there."
"What?" the sergeant said again.
"I'm only asking, 'cause, well, look at me," Laura went on, gesturing expansively. "I mean, stuff like this isn't supposed to happen on the upper levels, am I right? But no! I go out dancing last night, and the next thing I know, these three go-ganger punks are kicking the stang out of me, and so long to my bag. If Daddy hadn't shown up when he did, I'd be chained to some hut's throne by now. As it is, I gotta explain to the government back on Earth what happened to my passport. I mean, do you guys have some kind of deal with the Revnox where you just let him pull that crap, or were you all just too busy down the donut shop?"
The sergeant replied, too confused by all this to speak. People didn't talk to members of the Crimson Lance that way on Omega, not unless they were Eclipsers or Blue Suns looking for a firefight.
"Oh, for... what planet are you from?" Laura asked.
Behind the now completely flummoxed sergeant, his three subordinates were struggling not to laugh as their superior was faced off by this tiny, bruised, and toweringly pissed-off tourist girl.
"What?"
the sergeant said.
Laura put on an obviously fake look of puzzlement.
"Really? I never heard of Planet What?"
Then, in a voice that carried clearly to the other end of the concourse, she demanded,
"Do they speak standard on What?"
"I..." the sergeant said.
"Oh, for Zarquan's sake, I'm done with you,"
Laura said. And, shoving him aside, she marched between his giggling subordinates and passed the checkpoint into the docking ring.
"Come on, Daddy,"
she barked over her shoulder.
Sorry about that," Griffin said as he eased past the sputtering sergeant.
"Gets it from her Uncle Tom.
Wait up, sweetheart,"
he added in a harried dad voice, trotting after Laura. She maintained the same agitated princess body language until they rounded the corner out of sight of the concourse, then, as if a switch had been thrown, instantly reverted to her usual quiet, self-contained mien.
"Okay, that was pretty amazing," Griffin acknowledged as he fell in beside her.
"Infiltration tradecraft," she replied matter-of-factly in her normal voice. "That was a variation on strategy number 16 for gaining entry to a quinceañera without an invitation."
By the time the Lancers sorted themselves out from that little experience, we were aboard a short harbor to Barca. From there, we caught a Cunard Seleucian longliner to New Snowdonia. Victor was hospitality itself, as ever, opening his home and his enormous heart to Laura in a way that warmed what was left of mine. She was extremely wary of him at first, but no one, not even an ex-weapon with extensive training in faking social interactions, but absolutely no experience of actually having them, can stay wary of Victor for long. It took a little while for it to sink in that she wasn't expected to kill anyone, not being stockpiled or trained for some new mission, that she was out from under, free and clear, and at large in a galaxy that, quite frankly, owed her some good times. I stayed for nearly a month, which was a day or two longer than I dared. New Snowdonia was out at the arse end of the Crown Colonies, but it was still in the Rigel sector, one of the core sectors, and even as secure and isolated as Creedmoor was, it was only a matter of time before somebody got suspicious and word started getting around to people I didn't want to find me there. I thought to slip out unnoticed in the night, but I really should have known better by then.
"You are leaving," Laura said, her voice quiet but accusing, in the empty great hall of Victor Creed's country mansion. "I have to," Griffin told her. "I've already stayed too long. It's not safe. People are hunting me." "Let them come," she said, her jade eyes flashing. He shook his head, smiling sadly. "That wouldn't be a very good way of repaying Victor for his hospitality, would it? Besides, I have to get back to work. My name isn't going to clear itself."
"Then I will come with you."
"I wish I could let you," Griffin said. "I really do. But it's not your fight. Nothing's your fight anymore. After all we went through to get you this far, do you think I could do that to you?" Laura hesitated, as if surprised to find within herself a genuine desire to define a course of action. Then she said, "I want it to be my fight."
"I considered it. I genuinely did, God's help me, and I won't deny it. Because she was such a fierce little creature. Because she'd never actually wanted anything before in her life, and I hated to have to deny her. Because she was handy in a fight, and I knew we worked well together. Because she would have been the greatest apprentice any Asagiri Katsujin Kenryu master had ever had. Because I'd gotten used to having her around, and I would miss her. Because I knew she could handle the ride if I let her buy the ticket. But even as I did, I remembered picturing it during the battle in the facility, and knowing then that I could never do it. That I'd be no better than Rice and his cronies if I took her away from this safe haven and made her my weapon, even if she thought she wanted me to. 20 years later, before Goodyear, I'd have done it anyway. On that day, I still had enough of a heart left in me to tell her no. And, paradoxically, still enough of one left in me that doing so broke another little piece off.
Seeing that she wasn't convinced, Griffin put down his bag, crossed to her, and took her shoulders in his hands. "Laura," he said, "please. Do you trust me?" She searched his face with her eyes, grappling with the still alien concepts in the question he'd just asked. Then she nodded and said softly, "Yes." "Then stay here. Learn what Victor has to teach you. You don't need to fight any more. Later on, when you're older, you may decide that you want to. That's fine. But give it a while." He smiled his sad smile again. "Be a kid first." "I do not know what that means." "I know, but you will. You've got time." Another wrestling match with unfamiliar feelings in the words that described them. "I will miss you." Griffin bent and kissed her forehead. "I'll miss you too, Laura. But we'll see each other again someday. In the meantime, live. Grab your life with both hands. And always remember that you have the right to."
Laura nodded again.
I will, she said quietly.
She hesitated once more, and then, with the jerky motion of someone carrying out an unfamiliar action, hugged him.
Goodbye.
Oh, it's not goodbye, Griffin said gently, his hand on the back of her head. It's... On Seleucia, they say, Chiren ayer. Half-stepping back to look her in the eye, he translated, I await our next meeting. Then, hugging her again, he murmured, Chiren ayer, Laura. She said it back, her pronunciation perfect, and then went solemnly back to bed. Griffin stood alone in the hall for a moment, then picked up his bag and slipped quietly out the door.
That was nicely done, my friend, Victor rumbled from the shadows near his garden gate.
Griffin didn't seem surprised to find his host waiting for him in the night.
Thank you, he said. Don't let her come after me.
Victor chuckled, a sound like a lion stretching after a nap.
I suspect there breathes not a man who can stop that child from doing anything she pleases, he said. But I also believe your words will have their desired effect, until she feels she's been a child long enough, at any rate. Then, as Thomas is wont to say, all flamin' bets are off.
Griffin gave a hollow laugh.
May it be a long time coming.
May it indeed.
Listen. Thanks for this, said Griffin.
Not at all, my friend, Victor replied. It's but the smallest part of the favor I owe you, and besides, she and I are family, after a peculiar fashion. My home shall ever be open to her, and to you, so long as you need sanctuary. Permit me, in fact, to echo one of our young friend's sentiments. Should those who hunt you find you here, let them come.
Griffin shook his head. Thank you, Victor, but no. Like I told Laura, I have to get back to work anyway.
Very well. I know what it is to be driven by business one has left unfinished. But I mean what I say. Return whenever you like.
I may well one day, Griffin said. In the meantime... He considered something, came to an internal conclusion, and removed the data solid he'd recovered at the facility from an inside pocket. She's not ready for this yet, he said. She may not be for a long time. But when she is, she has a right to it. Victor took the module and turned it over in his hand.
What is it? He asked.
Her birthright, Griffin said. Her inheritance. Every scrap of information her makers had about her. And a message from her mother. Victor raised his eyebrows, then nodded gravely and tucked the module into his own pocket.
I shall see that she receives it when the time is right, he promised.
Thanks. For everything.
You are most welcome.
Victor clasped his arm and clapped his shoulder.
Clear skies, my friend. May you find what you seek.
With one glance back at the dark house on the hill, Griffin walked slowly out of the hills and into Clanfairpool Gwingle proper. It would be daylight by the time he reached the train station, midday before he'd be off-planet, but his mind was already looking to the next phase. Back to where he'd left 8-Ball 1, then on to the next way station. Chasing leads. Picking up the trail. 9:45 a.m., Thursday. IPO headquarters. The wall clock in Recovery 1 said it was mid-morning, 14 hours or thereabouts after the procedure, when the door opened and Wheatley arrived on his ceiling track.
Hello, all right,
he asked cheerfully, then paused and blinked in confusion at the sight which greeted him. The patient was out of bed, still dressed in the loose-fitting gray institutional PJs she'd been issued.
She had made the bed so neatly it looked like it had been made by some kind of special bed-making machine, and now she was standing in the empty space between the foot of the bed and the wall, moving in what looked to the AI like a very slow and deliberate, and oddly silent, dance.
What are you doing?
Wheatley asked after watching her for a few seconds.
Tai Chi Quan, she replied without breaking her flow.
Wheatley remained silent for a few more moments, observing, then rocked his housing after the fashion of a person shaking his head and said,
That is weird. Humans and their bodies, with limbs and everything.
Laura ignored him and finished the pattern, then turned to him and said, Is there something you needed? Wheatley appeared lost in contemplation of something for a moment. Then he recoiled slightly on his track, optic going wide.
Right, yes. I'm supposed to show you the way to Quartermaster Division so you can draw equipment, and then they want you in Danger 5.
10:07 a.m. Combat Simulation Training Center, Danger Room, Number 5. Laura arrived in the staging area of Danger Room 5 20 minutes later to find Griffin and Skuld waiting for her. Freshly outfitted in the midnight blue special assignment version of the IPO's standard tactical gear, she reminded Griffin immediately of their first meeting, though she was no longer the slightly skinny teenager she'd been then. Smiling a little at the memory, he said,
You look good?
I feel good, she confirmed.
Skuld completed a medical scan, closed her tricorder, and nodded confirmation.
All your systems check out, she said,
then added wryly, A person would never know we took you to the shivering edge of mortality last night.
It had to be done, Laura told her. I regret nothing. Neither should you.
Skuld's smile became a little less wry.
You're a plain-spoken soul, aren't you? She said. You'd fit right in where I come from.
One of my agents spotted Kimura getting off a freighter at the depot out on Kaiser Island at 0540 this morning, Griffin said. They tracked her onto one of the relay ships. She should be arriving on the mainland about 1630. Once she's in the Docklands, we'll steer her toward a place where you can fight it out without endangering the city.
Where? Laura asked.
He told her. The answer made her smile just a little. It was an excellent, even inspired, choice. For right now, I want to see how well you're adapting to your new reality, Griffin went on. Your mass has changed because of the bone plating, and your center of gravity may be slightly altered. I need to see for myself that you're really fit to fight. Then you can meet the gang and we'll start working on the plan.
Laura nodded.
Fair enough. Skuld and Griffin left the staging area and went up to the control booth. A moment later, his voice addressed Laura from the overhead.
Ready?
Ready, she confirmed. There was a moment's silence before a synthetic voice announced,
Simulation scenario loaded. Lobby assault. Program commences in 3, 2, 1.
The door in front of Laura opened onto a long, broad, marble-floored and granite-paneled room with a double row of heavy square columns. The lobby, it appeared, of some high-class but anonymous office building. A blinking red hollow marker at the far end indicated her objective, the elevator. Between it and her stood a public security checkpoint manned by several bored-looking rent-a-cops. A public security checkpoint that included a very prominent old-fashioned archway metal detector. Laura smiled slightly and stepped toward the checkpoint. 5:20 p.m., New Avalon. After work time, an hour or so to sunset, and even on a Thursday, Sallowtown's Queen Shiva Square was humming. Groups of young people moved here and there, getting warmed up for an evening's pub crawling or club hopping or just being out and about, filling the crisp autumn air with cheerful chatter in a dozen languages. They moved all unaware that the rooftops around the square were almost crowded with IPO Tactical Division officers, that no fewer than a dozen experts of justice were on alert in the general area,
and that the tall woman in the dark overcoat who had just emerged from the underground end station at the south end of the square was classified as a Class B threat to public safety. Kimura stood for a moment getting her bearings. She'd never been in this city before, and already she didn't like it. Too crowded, too noisy, too many cops. She had preferred Omega. On the other hand, there was something to be said for being at large anywhere with solid ground and ambient temperatures above 3 Kelvin. She hadn't suffered during her 7 decades and change as part of the Omega debris field because she hadn't been conscious for them. But all the same, she figured she owed somebody a beating for wasting her damn time. Besides those Trando salvagers who thought they could sell her to the Hutt Syndicate, what did they think she was, product? So it was just as well that the clone had come to this town, because once she finished with it, it was here she'd need to be anyway, to deal with the man responsible for that little inconvenience. She swept her eyes over the square, taking in the tactical picture. There were a couple of transit cops standing around by the other entrance to the end station, at the opposite corner of the square. Apart from that, she couldn't see anybody who looked like any kind of threat, just clumps of college kids out on the town. Near the stairway she'd just emerged from, a young woman was busking with an accordion, playing a cheery little French bal musette number. She had a small audience of mostly Seleucian youths. As Kimura stood sizing up the situation, the busker began to sing, her voice sweet and a little bit husky. The effect was lost on Kimura, as were the lyrics, though both seemed to amuse the girl's audience.
Attention, nous sommes blessés. Nous avons un homme, il s'appelle Jean-Michel, sa jambe est cassée.
Kimura turned her back on the music, tried to tune out the noise and focus. Her informant on Jisatsu had told her the clone had developed the habit of gravitating toward places with a jumping nightlife. Places like this. Some kind of reflexive impulse to observe the sapient contact its programming ensured it could never participate in, presumably. So it'd almost certainly be here, or in one of the other spots like this one in the city, most likely lurking on the periphery, trying to wrap its tiny clone mind around the reason why it could never tap into the human energy it saw all around it.
Avec une jeune fille, elle s'appelle Giselle, c'est si belle. Il montait dans un arbre pour faire l'amour.
If it had been living that way for the last 75 years, it must have come as close as such a limited intelligence could get to a state of constant misery. The thought made Kimura smile.
Il adoptait la position missionnaire. C'est populaire. Il est tombé, sa jambe est cassée. Attention!
The song finished with a reedy flourish. Behind her, Kimura heard the musician's audience start applauding, the sound of coins being dropped into the accordion case. Thank you, said the busker quietly, and Kimura felt the hairs on the back of her neck stand on end. Impossible, she thought. She whirled. The accordion stood abandoned next to its open case. The small group of young people who had been listening to its player didn't seem to think anything odd had happened. By the retaining wall at the back of the end station staircase, Kimura's quarry hesitated just long enough to make undeniable eye contact with her, then turned and ran. Ignoring the oddly unconcerned bystanders, Kimura let out a furious noise and charged after her. The George and Vulture, altitude 3,500 feet.
Griffin stood in the beautifully decorated mobile situation room tucked away in the employees-only area of the Hellfire Club's pleasure zeppelin, his hands clasped behind his back, and watched with satisfaction as the various tags and markers depicting his assets in the city below started moving, inserted holographically into the view through the crystal floor on which he stood.
"Command, this is Red Robin," a member of Laura's erstwhile audience in Queen Shiva Square reported through the lens network as Kimura set out in pursuit. "The game's afoot. I repeat, the game's afoot."
"Thank you, Mr. Drake," Griffin replied, widening his lens contact to include all the lensmen involved in this operation. The chief went on, "All units, look sharp, it's showtime. Captain Kessler, make your course west-southwest, if you please."
"Aye, aye, sire," the Zeppelin's mistress of ceremonies replied from up on the bridge, making a game, as she always did, of the honorary title he held as a member of the Hellfire Club's board of directors. He could feel that impish, smoldering smile of hers through the lens link, but he paid it little mind. Heather Kessler was another man's rhubarb, and besides, he was far too preoccupied with the tactical situation displayed beneath his feet. The icons of lensmen, TACTIV Special Mission Force troopers, and NAPD SWAT officers converged from all over the city to line the route being taken by the foot chase in progress below. This was a tricky business. The city had to be protected, the safety of the public assured, without tipping off Kimura that her every move was being watched from 24 angles.
"I know this is important to Laura, and I've given my word not to interfere, but by all the gods, I just want to set Deadpool on her," he remarked to the woman standing next to him. "I really, really do."
"It's not too late," Emma Frost noted hopefully.
"Emma, be good," Griffin replied without taking his eyes off the tactical plot.
"Pah," said Emma dismissively. "Why start now?"
Connaught Street West,